Hi, everybody, and welcome again to F This Movie, the podcast that neither retreats nor surrenders. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I am joined back from sabbatical in Las Vegas by Mr. JB.
Hello.
Welcome back. How was Las Vegas?
It's fun. I would suggest to any of our listeners who are thinking about going, go.
Top five Las Vegas movies. Go.
The original Ocean's 11.
Okay.
And then I would suggest the remake of Ocean's 11,
okay,
which I'm a fan of. Skip 12. Man, 12 is bad. And I'm actually also a fan of 13.
That's only three, and they're all Ocean's movies.
True.
You forgot What Happens in Vegas, also Honeymoon in Vegas.
Those are bad.
Also,
I thought
Vegas,
you wanted five good
Vegas
movies.
Vacation.
Vegas Vacation has its moments.
Casino.
Casino.
And Ben-Hur.
Well, no. After the chariot race scene, they retire to Caesar's Palace
for some
gambling. Jake actually watched Casino on the plane on the way.
So he would get all the references?
So that he wouldn't do anything that would cause them to take him in the back room.
Good.
And put his head in a vice.
That seems unpleasant.
Which is odd in a city devoted to vice.
Hey!
I'll be here all week.
You learned a little something from Vegas Club Comics. So F This Movie, go to our website at fthismovie.blogspot.com and email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. And now, after weeks of whining and
this
crying...
This is tremendous, folks.
Yes! After weeks of whining and crying on the podcast, we have to thank Eric Asperschlager, my colleague and friend at DVD Verdict and co-host of the Scott Pilgrim vs. the World podcast, for devoting the time and figuring out the script or coding or whatever computer people call it to get
the bribe to Steve Jobs
to get all of our past shows available in the iTunes store. So now when you search F This Movie in iTunes, you will see all 48 of our past shows.
And I've mentioned this before, and I don't know, somehow people doubted me. There were three shows from the past, especially, just off the top of my head, I believe they were the Wolfman remake, Inception,
yes,
and Ghostbusters,
hmm,
that were literally going for thousands of dollars on eBay on bootleg DVD. And there was this one joker selling them on a flash drive that, oddly enough, looked like a little plastic F. It was he took the
extra time to
theme it.
That's kind of neat. So they're all available. Thank you, Eric Asperschlager. We owe you
bottles of Jägermeister.
Bottles of Jägermeister. So all 48 of our shows are available just in time because iTunes will only show 50. So now they're all on just in time for them to start getting pushed out.
Is that really true?
Yeah, that's true of every show. That's not just our show. That
I'm sure glad I downloaded me those first five.
Yeah, you definitely want Avatar and Young Guns while you can still get them. Just kidding. Anyway, tonight we're talking about Galaxy Quest by request from a listener. Brian Hunt from Orem, Utah asked us to F either Lost Boys or Galaxy Quest. And we flipped a coin and we came up with Galaxy Quest.
Can I make one quick comment about Lost Boys?
Absolutely.
I've been saying in class for decades, Lost Boys would be a classic.
Yeah.
It was the first movie to do a whole bunch of things in terms of vampire movies. But there's one thing that ruins it. Two things that ruin it.
Yeah.
You take the Corys out of that movie, and it's a masterpiece.
Yeah.
Man, what were they thinking?
Because I saw that movie when I was a kid, and that's who the Corys were sort of targeted to, they don't bother me as much in that movie as they do in future movies when they really had their little Cory shtick down. Because in that movie, at least Corey Feldman is sort of trying to play a character.
True.
So.
My
problem is with Jameson Newlander.
The whole thing, though, about teenagers wanting to be vampires because... you stay all night and sleep all day. You live forever. You get to travel in this cool goth pack. That's fantastic. Arguably one of the better last lines in horror movie history.
Yeah, definitely.
A whole bunch of things it does really well.
And it's one of the few movies where Joel Schumacher's aesthetic actually works before the movie.
Very true. So get yourself a program. I don't know, off the top of my head, just hypothetically, it might be called Handbrake. And what you want to do is suck the movie off the DVD. Notice how technical these instructions are. Suck the movie off of DVD, dump it into a editing program, edit the Corys out.
Hmm.
You'll have an hour-long film that's a masterpiece.
Still with too much Jamie Gertz. Before we start talking about Galaxy Quest, I have to ask, JB, have you seen anything good lately?
No.
You haven't watched anything at home even? Doesn't mean you had to have gone out to a theater.
I watched Galaxy Quest.
You watched The Sweet Smell of Success.
I did. Criterion put that out a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
On Blu-ray. It is one of the most unique movies ever made.
That's the movie where Michael J. Fox pretends to be two people, right? The poor farm boy and the upscale yuppie city guy.
No, isn't that the movie with Bette Midler and Lily Tomlin as twins of themselves, and they keep almost meeting,
right?
Which once inspired Roger Ebert to write one of the funniest reviews he's ever read. He said, "What were the screenwriters thinking? They keep narrowly missing each other. So are we in the audience supposed to sit here and say, 'Boy, they almost met,' then something funny would have happened?"
I've seen that movie. I don't remember.
This is Sweet Smell of Success. Yes. It was written by Ernest Lehman and the other screenwriter. I'm drawing a blank. And it was directed by Alexander McKendrick. And it was produced by Burt Lancaster's company because he plays this iconic role. And Tony Curtis is in it. And it is unbelievably good. But put on your seatbelts. It has a view of human nature and of humankind that is just so dark. It is one of the darkest, most cynical films ever made. Tons of famous lines, my favorite being, "I'd hate to take a bite out of you, Sydney. You're a cookie full of arsenic." They once tried to turn it into a Broadway musical, which
that didn't work out. I can't believe it.
Which played in Chicago before
Sweet Smell of Success, Turn Off the Dark.
And I think Julie Traymore got fired off that one, too.
Yeah.
This was called Sweet Smell of Success. I don't know where.
With an exclamation point, though, right?
It was just called Sweet with an exclamation point. I don't know where they shoehorned the musical numbers in. John Lithgow played the J.J. Hunsaker character.
This was pretty recent. No?
Maybe 5-6 years ago.
Okay. It was after this whole trend of let's turn everything into a musical. Okay.
Right. And it promptly went to Broadway and failed. But if you can, see the original. It is breathtaking in its meanness and cruelty. It's a bitter, bitter film.
All right, excellent. I had the pleasure of seeing a movie called Battle Los Angeles this weekend. And just do me a favor, when I said, "Hey, I saw Battle Los Angeles," what was your response?
You said pleasure, and I don't know what you thought of it, and I really liked the trailer.
Right.
And I wanted to see it.
Right.
And I can't tell from your affect right now with an A, I can't tell what you thought of it.
Well, I think you had the appropriate initial response because I saw the trailer. I said, "That looks neat. That looks great." That, to me, is what a trailer should be because now, you know, marketing departments are so afraid of an audience not knowing exactly what they're going to get that they spell out every single beat. We were just discussing the trailer for Paul, which spells out every beat of that movie. And I thought, boy, Battle Los Angeles seems to just suggest some imagery that might be part of a larger story. And it doesn't give everything away. And that's exciting to me. So I wanted to see the movie.
Here it comes.
And I went to see the movie. And guess what? The trailer actually does give everything away. Because that's the movie. There's nothing to be spoiled. It is the end of narrative cinema.
Okay. So it's the entire thing is third act.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But a terrible third act. It's the closest. it's like, and I don't think this is original to me because I've read a few reviews that have suggested as much. It's the equivalent of sitting down and watching someone else play a video game. You're thrown right into the story. There is zero exposition. At one point, they try and back up a little bit, and they try and give you a little bit of like, well, this guy's getting married, and this guy has a kid on the way, and this guy lost some people in the Middle East, and he is upset about that. But that's it for exposition. Otherwise, it's just, we got to get from here to there. There's no story moving forward. It's literally just clearing a level. And the dialogue is atrocious, and the action is staged so confusingly that you never know what's going on. It's just a lot of handheld camera work. The director seems to be thinking that he's sort of reinventing the Alien Invasion movie as like a combat film, but that's essentially what James Cameron did in Aliens, right?
I mean, it's been done plenty of times before, going back to the 50s.
Right. So it's terrible, and more than once characters are shouting things like, we got to get you home. But you have to ask yourself, well, where is home? All of Los Angeles is decimated. Where are they trying to go? And they never actually answered that question. Like, we got to get out of here. We got to go to there. But where is there? Because there's nowhere to go. So it's incredibly just bleak and horrible, especially given what's going on, obviously, in the world right now. But it made a bunch of money, and I had told my wife, because she's a high school teacher, I said, you're going to have students that love this movie because it reminds them of playing a video game.
And that's interesting. So what I was originally responding to wasn't a movie. It was a marketing campaign where someone had the idea that it would be very disconcerting to have a trailer with a lot visually going on in it, with explosions and things flying through the air, and have no natural sound, no sound effects, just this very creepy electronic version of Blue Skies. Mm-hmm. And it was chilling.
Yeah.
So I had high hopes. When the second trailer came out, which didn't have any of
I don't think I've ever seen the second trailer.
It's a boom, 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 okay. And let's get you home, and the helicopter goes up with half the family and explodes.
Right.
And my wife's reaction was, why in hell would I want to see that? That looks like the bleakest, most horrible thing ever. And remember, her now famous response to the trailer for Unstoppable was, do you think they'll stop that train? But when you see the second trailer for Battle LA, there's no way we're going to win.
Right.
Do the aliens catch cold the way they do at the end of the original War of the Worlds? Is this our only
hope? It turns out they're all allergic to water.
That the microbe, the smallest creature that God put on the earth, would prove to be man's salvation. Cue organ music.
You sound exactly in this like
film from the 50s.
Morgan Freeman. Oh, you weren't talking about the remake. Oh, sorry. So, wait, there's an original War of the Worlds?
Yeah, it's terrific.
No, I like that movie a lot.
Getting back to what we're going to talk about tonight, proving that we're the two perfect men to discuss this film.
Yes.
I recently bought a model, for those of you younger than 40, a model is plastic pieces, and you have to put it together following directions. Mm. There are no batteries, there's no screen.
You lost me.
And you have to glue it together and then paint it so that it looks like what it's supposed to be. It's not a toy that you buy that's ready to go. You have to put it together. And I bought it a couple weeks ago, and it's the alien from War of the Worlds.
Oh, cool.
The original War of the Worlds, which officially classifies me.
Color things?
The three colored eye and the suction cup fingers. He's only in two shots, and they keep him under wraps.
Yeah.
But the fact that I have bought a model of the Martian from War of the Worlds classifies me as a geek.
Yes.
As a nerd. As the same type of person who's at a science fiction convention, which is where Galaxy Quest begins.
Yes, and that is a beautiful segue, and I'm not trying to step on it, but I'm just going to remind everyone, or let our listeners know, that this weekend we're actually going to go sit through a science fiction marathon of movies at the Music Box Theater.
The happiest place on earth, and our friend Rusty Nails is doing it. And it's not quite as long as the horror fest that's put on in October. It's a little bit shorter, but it's called the Sci-Fi Spectacular, And if you have nothing to do this Saturday, that would be the 19th.
That sounds right.
It starts at noon. It's really, really fun. And it's all science fiction, which gets us back to Galaxy Quest.
Galaxy Quest. I don't really know the best way to jump into Galaxy Quest, aside from the segue that you just gave, except to say...
And you ruined.
Sometimes it's... Sometimes on F This Movie, we talk about very popular movies that everyone has seen or that are beloved.
And sometimes we talk about the reasons that we've been arrested in the past. But those are the parts of the podcast that Patrick edits. And in some cases, those are whole shows that he puts in his safety deposit box in case Doug and I ever decide to run for elective office.
What I was going to say is that sometimes we do shows on movies that maybe not everyone has seen that we're trying to draw attention to. And Galaxy Quest, I think, is one of those movies. I think it's one of those movies that not necessarily a lot of people have seen, but I think everyone who has seen it really likes it. I think it's a movie that a group of people have a lot of affection for.
And no less an authority than David Mamet, who you wouldn't ordinarily think of being mentioned in the same sentence as Galaxy Quest. In one of his recent books, Bambi Meets Godzilla, which is his sort of multi-chapter treatise on Hollywood and how Hollywood works, no less an authority than David Mamet, the this country's greatest living playwright, called it a perfect movie. He held it up as an example, narrative-wise, in terms of construction, as a perfect movie. And the first time I read that, it really spun my head around, and I thought, is he being arch? Is he being sarcastic? But he's not being sarcastic at all. And at this point, shout out, mad props, to my son Jake, who, when he was younger, had unerringly good taste in the movies that he would watch over and over again. He was really good at spying out undiscovered gems. Saw Galaxy Quest, loved Galaxy Quest. Galaxy Quest came out on either DVD or VHS, and he watched it a lot. He was at that age where he would watch it over and over and over again. And I remember he did the same thing with Bowfinger, which, again, I consider this undiscovered gem of a movie.
They came out the same year.
Galaxy Quest, Bowfinger, Quick Change. Groundhog Day gets all the attention.
Yeah.
Quick Change is a masterpiece.
Yeah, it's great.
It's so funny, and also features Tony Shalhoub,
that's
who's
right.
in Galaxy Quest.
Who's hilarious in Galaxy Quest.
And really funny in as the cab driver who can't speak English at all.
Bluff Tooney. Bluff Tooney. Hung, hung, Bluff Tooney. I love Quick Change.
So Galaxy Quest begins.
Yeah.
And I watched it again to refamiliarize myself with it, and I was really surprised... It's rated PG.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a rarity these days, a PG-rated comedy. And I thought, boy, they're going to have to earn the laughs and not just swear to get a laugh.
Or have an alien poo on them or something.
And in the first 10 minutes, we get an example of the film trying for a PG. And I never noticed this before. In the first 10 minutes of the film, someone says, "You are so full of it." And it's looped.
Yeah.
And that's not the original line. And I think at the end, they dubbed over one of Sigourney Weaver's lines.
They did. You can see it.
To take it
down.
And I mean,
I'm glad it's rated PG and everything, because I will want to show this to my son sooner than later.
And I'm not a blue nose, and I want a film to be whatever rating it needs to be.
But that would have been such a big laugh if the original line had been kept in, I think. Sigourney Weaver's line?
Yeah. I'm glad you're telling me this, because when I watched it, I wasn't quite sure, and
you
I didn't
roll it back.
You
could see her mouth
it, yeah. But in the early 21st century, perhaps thanks to Mr. Apatow, comedy is becoming synonymous with R.
Right.
And I remember Steven Spielberg saying something that even as early as the 70s, you said the S word, you got to laugh. It was automatic.
Right.
Audiences would laugh at that. And that's why in Jaws, he has Roy Scheider say the word, and then the shark appears.
Right.
Because he said he wanted to turn a laugh into a scream. And he did.
Yeah.
So hats off to Galaxy Quest for being PG.
Galaxy Quest is, to me, the kind of movie that hardly exists anymore. And that is, it is, at least when I saw it, it's such a pleasant surprise. I saw it when it came out back in 99, and this was back in the days where I used to go see 4 or 5 movies in a day. And it just happened to work with the times. It wasn't something that I was really seeking out because I wasn't, you know, the world's biggest Tim Allen fan. There wasn't necessarily anything about the movie that really drew me to it. I wasn't that into Star Trek yet. And so it just kind of fit in with the time. And I saw it, and it really snuck up on me, and I really liked it. And I don't think the pleasant surprise hardly exists anymore for a lot of the reasons I was talking about with Battle Los Angeles, which is just that you can't keep movies secrets anymore. You know, everything is just marketed to death. You know everything that you're getting going in. So it's rare to see a movie that you don't see coming. And it actually reminded me of the Book of Eli effect that you're always talking about, that I think part of what you're responding to is, wow, that was a really pleasant surprise.
And every time I've seen it after the first time, I'm struck by the hundreds of ways this movie could have gone wrong,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I was surprised because given the director and the screenwriters, this is their magnum opus.
Right.
They've done other things,
right.
A lot of TV,
yeah.
for everybody. The co-writer wrote Men in Black 2.
Yeesh.
Yeah.
That's nothing to be proud of.
It really seems that the pieces came together in a way that you know, fortune smiled upon them because this is a really nice piece of work. The film begins at a science fiction convention, specifically a Galaxy Quest convention. Specifically, a Star Trek convention.
Right.
And I have to say, within the realm of the film, because Patrick can speak to this, both of us have actually gone to these conventions.
Yeah.
They get it right. And it's hard to get it right, because they can't use any of the recognizable icons
right.
from Star Trek. Because clearly that's what's being played around with here. But I would say they get the details of the science fiction convention right. Although when I rewatched it, I noticed something very strange, and I wonder if this is a production designer having a little joke. Clearly, it's a Star Trek convention. In one of the scenes, Tim Allen is talking to Sigourney Weaver on the convention floor,
mm-hmm.
and behind Tim Allen, there's a cardboard Frankenstein, and behind Sigourney Weaver, there's a cardboard mummy. Later, in Justin Long's bedroom,
mm-hmm.
in the background, there's a little bust of Frankenstein.
Hmm.
So, of course, I notice these things because I'm more of a horror fan than a science fiction fan. And certainly at some of these conventions, everything's mixed together.
Right.
And it's just like, right. what do fat guys like? And that, I thought, was the one thing they got wrong. Because when I go to Comic-Con in Illinois, and when I go to Wonderfest or Horror Hound or Flashback Weekend or any of the myriad conventions you can go to, everybody looks like me. There's a big connection between I fell in love with these films as a kid and I lead a sedentary lifestyle. But it's a movie, so everybody's thin.
You had talked about all the ways that Galaxy Quest could have gone wrong, and what amazes me still about the movie, and it's something that you and I have spoken about before, actually, in reference to Kick-Ass. I remember driving home from Kick-Ass and having this conversation, and I was watching some of the special features on the Blu-ray today, and they interview Nicholas Meyer, who directed the best Star Trek movie he did, Wrath of Khan.
And Time After Time.
And Time After Time. And Volunteers with Tom Hanks. So anyway, Wrath of Khan is a great movie. And they have him on one of the featurettes just talking about how much he likes Galaxy Quest. And he references this phenomenon that you and I have spoken about, which is that it's one of these movies, he calls it, you know, Galaxy Quest is a movie that has its cake and eats it too. That it's a movie that is able to make fun of something, but also really work as that thing.
As a narrative, because at the end, we actually care about these characters.
Right.
And there are things at the end of the film that are truly moving.
Right. And as much as even, you know, that it wants to goof on the fans at these science fiction conventions, obviously it is the fans who come through, who help save the world, who love this thing. and who eventually, you know, that thing loves them back, which is a nice thing to see as a fan of this kind of stuff. But there are not many movies that are able to pull that trick off. We had talked about it with Kick-Ass. Edgar Wright's first two movies, I think, succeed. That Shaun of the Dead is making fun of zombie movies, but is also a great zombie movie. And the same with Hot Fuzz. Tropic Thunder tries to do it. Tropic Thunder is almost the same story as Galaxy Quest. Three Amigos, Tropic Thunder, Galaxy Quest are sort of the three that do this.
And there's a lot to like in Tropic Thunder. I think I like that film more than you do. You found with each revisit it had diminishing returns.
Yeah, and I think the opposite is true of Galaxy Quest.
I agree, but although I think there's a lot to like in Tropic Thunder, that does not apply to Tropic Thunder.
No.
It does not work as a narrative at all.
Right. And Three Amigos is the other movie that, again, they all sort of have the same conceit, which is a group of people masquerading as this one thing are called upon to be that thing. And I don't mind Three Amigos. I don't have the affection for it that some other people in my generation do because it was on HBO a lot when we were kids. It's fine, but I don't love it. And I'm not a big Tropic Thunder fan. So actually, of the three, I really like Galaxy Quest. But I'm amazed at how it, sometimes even in the span of a single scene, that it's able to kind of goof on, again, Star Trek is basically what it's making fun of, but at the same time show genuine affection for this thing.
A good example of that, and again, I don't want this to turn into the Chris Farley show, is at the end, the Tim Allen character, the Sigourney Weaver character, are forced to sort of walk this gauntlet of danger, and they have to go through something called the Chompers, which are enormous steel pistons that come down with great force and will squash you like a bug. And in the exact same scene, I mean, in the space of a minute, Sigourney Weaver says, "Who would invent this? What does this do? There's no reason for this to be here."
Right.
And yet their navigating of it is clever and suspenseful.
Yeah.
And at the end of that, she says, "That was a poorly written scene." And usually that sort of arch, self-aware postmodernism comes across that way. But it's a really funny line in the movie, and it works.
And I'm always amazed.
Who wrote that episode?
And that's where her great joke was looped, because when she first sees the Chompers, her original reaction in the script and what they shot is her saying, "Oh, fuck this," and they loop it, so now it's "Screw This," which I would argue is not as funny.
No.
Otherwise, we'd be hosting a show called "Screw This Movie," and who would listen to that?
That's funny, because no one listens to this.
It's a testament, again, to the cleverness of the screenplay, I think, that when we get to, on the other side of the Chompers, they need to turn off, they have to stop a bomb, basically.
Yes.
They have to stop something from melting down and destroying the ship. And obviously, the movie introduces, you know, a deus ex machina, but it's a funny joke.
Yeah.
It's not just, "What a coincidence, phew," you know, what
and
a relief.
It speaks to every movie that has ended
right.
with some sort of device counting
right.
down.
Right. It's a good joke. It makes sense within the universe that the movie has set up. It's a really clever movie, and I think clever is hard to do and isn't done that often.
And going back to our point about science fiction fans, Justin Long is in this movie. Justin Long is really, really good in
yeah.
this movie. And I understand this was his first movie. And there will be no spoiler alert, because I would never want to ruin this. Justin Long has the single greatest line in this movie. A line that will make all movie nerds, horror nerds, science fiction nerds rejoice. Also, in a very small part, this film features Rainn Wilson.
Yeah.
He's only in a couple shots
yeah.
as one of the aliens.
Yeah.
He's very funny, although, again, not as funny as, help me with the pronunciation here,
Enrico Colantoni.
Enrico Colantoni, who I had previously known from Just Shoot Me.
Yeah.
He's amazing in this movie.
Yeah.
Not only the way they came up with for the aliens to walk, but that voice where he's obviously breathing in to speak
right,
instead
right.
of breathing out.
Right.
And then even with all that affect, this really sort of amazing character who starts as this naive figure of fun and then by the end of the film convinces us maybe that's a way to live your life.
Right.
Which I'm hoping we'll get into. So the end of this podcast might... Okay, I'm just... Okay.
As I
rewatched it, I began to think things that have not been expressed on F This Movie before.
Oh, all right. Now I'm nervous.
Be afraid.
Again, and again, like you said, it's a testament to the way the movie is written that it actually can be moving at times, that when we get to the point where Alan Rickman plays, you know, the Spock character who really sort of resents his lot in life. He was going to be a Shakespearean actor, and instead he's wearing this stupid head prosthetic and saying this catchphrase at the opening of Electronic Stores. By Grab Thar's hammer,
you will be avenged. And people want him to say it.
Right.
And he resents it.
Right.
And again, as my wife pointed out as we watched the film again, as much as the Tim Allen character might be a figure of fun at the beginning of the film, I think it's interesting that at the beginning he's very, he's certainly more into it than they are. Mm-hmm. They're just tired of the whole game. And at least he's trying for the fans. Mm-hmm. They show him interacting with fans and sort of having some fun with a kid. And then later he overhears a conversation in the bathroom, mm-hmm. which demoralizes him. And then he becomes more bitter still. But before they go out at the science fiction convention, it's established that, I guess, like a lot of famous Shakespearean actors, the Alan Rickman character has horrible stage fright. Mm-hmm. And yet the Tim Allen character knows how to deal with that, and it's the Tim Allen character who gets him
right.
to go out, which right. I thought was a nice sort of subtle foreshadowing that for all their bickering, there's tremendous affection between these characters still. They just haven't right. found a place yet where they can share it.
Right. And all I was going to say was that by the time we get to the point in the movie where Alan Rickman actually has to deliver that line, again, it's actually kind of moving when it happens.
It's tremendously moving
yeah.
because, and hopefully we can address this, a lot of the film is about art versus reality
right.
or illusion versus reality. I'm pretending to be a hero. I can't be a real hero. On the TV show, the Alan Rickman character says it in this demonstrative, outrageous way. And the reason why it works at the end of the film is that it's very understated
mm-hmm.
and it's very realistic,
mm-hmm.
considering, and I don't want to get too odd or confusing here, but it's always struck me that when you have any sort of film like Galaxy Quest, or what I sometimes talk about in class, the Shakespeare plays that feature plays inside of them,
right.
The Pyramus and Thisbe scene in Midsummer Night's Dream, you have to remember that the same writer wrote the reality of the piece,
mm-hmm.
and then had to write the play within a play to be bad.
Right.
It has to sound different and be bad. So we have the same writers who are writing the honestly emotional stuff in Galaxy Quest that will pull your heartstrings, but then they have to write the show, which we see as silly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really hard.
Yeah.
And I think it's a testament to Alan Rickman that it's certainly the most moving point in the film, and maybe it's because in the reality of the film, he's actually reacting to something that happened. Because a lot of the film is about reality, we're washed up actors, versus illusion. We played these characters that are actually inspirational, specifically to these aliens who don't know what a television show is. It also, I think, speaks to the emotional relationship that a lot of us forge with certain fictions. I'm an English teacher, and most English teachers can actually point to the book that turned them into a reader, that turned them into a lover of reading. And so that work would have a very special meaning for them. And so even though these actors are washed up and cranky and very angry about certain things, the fans of Galaxy Quest are fans of that show for a very specific reason.
Mm-hmm.
And if anything, the film suggests that that's not an unhealthy thing at all,
mm-hmm.
especially if you choose something that's worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
The aliens have seen the television show, I guess because it was beamed into outer space in some way. but they don't know what a television show is because they really don't know what lying is. And so they refer to it as the historical documents. And they base their whole civilization on it. In fact, at one point, the aliens said, our race was in disarray. And by following the precepts of your show, of courage, of friendship, of strength, we came back as a civilization. And they've modeled their whole civilization after it. Mm-hmm. And you have to admit, the aliens, and we see them in their human form, which is a projection, but they're actually sort of squid-like,
right.
Rubbery creatures. Stan Winston's studio did most of those special effects. Mm-hmm. That the aliens are indescribably happy, mm-hmm. and positive people, which I think gives us a lot of food for thought, given that they're aping a show on which all of the real people are miserable.
Right.
Because they haven't yet been sort of emboldened by the adventure. As I was watching it, I kept thinking of two things. One is a famous quote by Kurt Vonnegut Jr., who once said, we are who we pretend to be. So we have to be very careful about who we pretend to be.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my favorite lines from Quiz Show, the Robert Redford film that should have won the Academy Award that year. I watch it once a year, and every time I watch it, I find something new in it. In the film, Paul Scofield plays the father, and he's an English teacher, Mark Van Doren, who was a real guy. And he's teaching Don Quixote. He's teaching Man of La Mancha to his class. And there's a student, Ethan Hawke's first film role, I believe, who asks him a question about Don Quixote. And it's the end of class, and the bell is rung, and he's you know, he doesn't want to be in class anymore. So he's being very short with the student, but he says, what he's saying is, if you want to be a knight, act like a knight. And the older I get, the more I think those are really good words of wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
The actors have played these heroic, courageous, wonderful, strong characters, and they can't find it within themselves to be that way. And yet, to the aliens, this is a model of the way one should act. Another thing I think the film is talking about is a sense of wonder that one can have at certain things. That Tim Allen keeps referring, well, the original set was plywood and it was cheap plastic and stuff. And I think a key scene is when he first goes up in the spaceship and they cover him with that goo and they send him back. We get this amazing special mm-hmm. effect of the universe above him. And it's very beautiful and it's full of wonder. The first shot of the Omega 13 is very, it's very deep and it's full of moving, spinning spheres. Mm-hmm. And it's very wonderful that they sort of lost that sense of wonder. And I think largely the film is about getting it back.
Have you ever seen the documentary Trekkies?
No.
You should check it out. Because it's sort of speaking to a lot of the same things that Galaxy Quest is talking about. And I have a theory, and I don't know if this is confirmed in the special features or not. There's a kid that's prominently featured in Trekkies that I think Justin Long is really modeling his character after. But it's speaking to this, you know, to the idea that we all have something that we sort of build our lives around. We find this way to construct our identity. You and I sort of do it through movies, you know, and that's why we're on a movie podcast. And
these, sort of
these people, well, because I split it between movies and mescaline, but these people obviously have chosen Star Trek, and they're sort of made to be outcasts because of it. But the, you know, and as much as Trekkies on the one hand is sort of maybe put there for you to sort of laugh at these people, at the same time it's saying, well, what's wrong with this? These people are happy and they get something out of it. And most of them are actually pretty intelligent and bring a lot of that intelligence, you know, to their affection for the show. And what's wrong with that? If that makes them happy, it's not hurting anyone, obviously. And Galaxy Quest obviously is saying some of the same things about the fans. Anyway, it's saying, you know, that this is, that these people have established a community together, and the community stretches all the way out into outer space.
As I watched the film, different things kept floating through my head, especially how adept the film is at talking about larger issues without ever being preachy or obvious or pointing it out or making it insultingly specific or explaining a joke. That I'm watching the film and I'm thinking of the old trope that fiction is a lie that gets to the truth. And one thing I noticed was, and I've noticed this in a lot of films, specifically Westerns, that what differentiates the bad guys from the good guys is that because the bad guys hold life so meaningless, and life does not have meaning, and that because life has no intrinsic value for them, they also don't really respect death in any way, and that in a Western, the bad guys will kill someone and ride away. And what differentiates the settlers in these Westerns is that not only does life have meaning, but that death has meaning, that death is very important. And I see them doing this in Galaxy Quest, because we actually care when the alien leader character is being tortured, and for a period of time, we think he's dead, and that has great meaning. And the bad guys, I'm trying to think of the name of the head, the tentacles on his head. They all have funny names that are series of letters. That he knows that the ship is going to blow up, and yet orders his men back on the ship.
Right.
Obviously having no concern for their lives, and that one of the things that makes Rickman's big scene, which we just discussed, have meaning is that to the good guys, death does have meaning. Death is important. It's important that this person lived and that we pay attention to it. And I don't think we're used to getting that in a comedy that's sort of supposed to be this happy-go-lucky. What if the Star Trek cast?
right.
And that's one reason.
High concept that way.
That's one reason why I think the trailer didn't have to give it all away. Because say what you want, it's a wonderful concept that's very easy to explain to someone.
Right.
What if the Star Trek cast was kidnapped and actually put in space to have an adventure?
And it's nice to see that the movie doesn't just, as you said, sort of rest on that, but it's actually about something much more.
And yet you still get very funny jokes.
Yeah.
That the Sigourney Weaver character was actually cast in the original television show, obviously to be the sexy girl, and she has nothing to do, which I'm assuming is some sort of reference to Nichelle Nichols in the original show.
Just even the role of any woman in science fiction.
Who didn't have anything to do.
Right.
But it still makes me laugh that, A, her job was to listen to what the computer said, which is in English, and then repeat it to the rest of the crew, sometimes in slightly different language. And that's very, very funny, especially looking at an old TV show and seeing that they were doing that. But what I noticed this time when I watched it, and in one of the scenes they're in a room and they're trying to solve a problem, and they're all talking to the computer, and the computer will only answer her, because the aliens have built the computer to be just like the one on the television show.
Right.
And that's really funny. And then as the adventure continues, her clothing gets ripped, and so that more and more of her bust is exposed.
And so while you have this joke that she's not just the woman in the science fiction thing, that she's more than that, she's smarter than that, she's more capable than that, at the same time, they're just repeating that joke by getting her more and more sexualized as the movie goes on.
And I think the single best example of that is there's this wonderful rock creature who's very big and is comprised, sorry, it's late, of boulders. And when Tim Allen squares off against this thing, he loses his shirt. And I got to say, Tim Allen buffed up nice for this movie because he looks pumped up. And when he gets back aboard the ship, everyone makes mention, I noticed you were able to lose your shirt again. Yeah. And another example of this sort of postmodernism that works as a critique of the original show and yet actually works on its own is Sam Rockwell is in this movie.
That's where I was going to go next,
Guy Fliegman. We don't find out his name until the end of the movie, because throughout the film, it's very important and very scary that he doesn't have a name. Sam Rockwell's never given a bad performance in a movie, as far as I know. And he has really a very small part in this that is hilarious.
Because he has such a great arc, too, that you watch him become a hero over the course of the movie.
Yes.
And it's so good. And that reveal at the end where you get his last name and he turns around, that makes me laugh. The look he gives makes me laugh every time.
And Patrick and I have been to film screenings and conventions, especially conventions that feature people selling their autographs.
Yes.
And Sam Rockwell is the person who was on one episode.
Right.
And that is their life.
Right.
And he signed on as this sort of assistant master of ceremonies at this science fiction convention. Because I was in episode 82. I was in episode 82. And no one remembers him because he died in the first 10 minutes.
Right.
So when the cast goes on a real adventure, he is scared shitless because he knows he's going to die. And I give the film credit for this because my memory of it was that Alan had the line. But he doesn't. It's Tony Shalhoub, who we should talk about in a second. Tony Shalhoub has the line. Sam Rockwell is having a conniption fit. He knows he's going to die because his character doesn't have a name. He's crewman number 6 or something. And Shalhoub takes him aside and says, wait a minute. What if you're the plucky comic relief? And that emboldens him to survive the real adventure.
Right.
And become everything he's ever dreamed.
Because he's just seconds away from sacrificing himself, again, as a hero. And I love seeing that arc, that he has accepted his destiny. And Galaxy Quest was one of the first things I ever saw that sort of articulated that phenomenon, I think, in the last 10 years or so. It's become very popular, especially with fans of Star Trek. They refer to them as red shirts. Because it was always the guy in the red shirt that got killed as soon as they land on the planet in Star Trek. And so they're referred to as red shirts, but Galaxy Quest was really the first place that I saw articulate that phenomenon that no, there's always the extra crewman who dies and then the rest of the cast, you know, is able to escape or defeat the evil.
And Tony Shalhoub plays a character who has an Asian name and then his character on Galaxy Quest has an Asian name.
Right.
So clearly, George Takei, is Sulu. But really, in the reality of Galaxy Quest, he's Scotty.
Right.
He's the guy in the engine room.
Right.
And it's such a wonderful, unique performance that I haven't quite wrapped my head around it, because the first couple times I saw it, he sort of seemed to be a pothead.
Right.
But I think more to the point, he's sort of this Zen character.
Right.
Who will not allow anything to bother him.
Right.
And every line reading is amazing in its offhanded...
Right. Well, because, again, it's a very talented cast. Not even necessarily people... You know, I'm not the world's biggest Tim Allen fan, but I think he's great in the movie. And there's a very specific scene, I think, when they are first going through what they think is a cloud and turns out to be a minefield... And everyone is very animated and very loud. And everyone is shouting, and, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And Tony Shalhoub comes over the monitor. Hey, guys. And that right there makes me laugh. And then he tells them something. So just FYI. His energy is so different from everybody else in the movie. And he finds such a unique way to be funny that's different from everyone else.
The scene where the engine room has been damaged.
Yeah.
Hey, guys. They're telling me that we really don't have any energy to do anything. I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah.
But there's a couple things I can try. And I'm going to do that. Unless you don't want... And it's just amazing. And actually, his character winds up with romance in another film highlight, as far as I'm concerned. The aliens have made themselves look human so that the humans won't get upset or will be disconcerted or something. And there's a female alien who obviously has her eyes on the Shalhoub character. And at the end of the film, they begin to kiss. And behind him, her octopus form comes up. And it's clearly tentacles that are sort of embracing him and tickling him in various ways. And he stops kissing her and he looks at her. And she gives a look like, well? And he gives a look like, what the hell? And they fall out of the frame, and he's clearly making love to an octopus. And Sam Rockwell.
I mean, his line is just, "That's not right," which I can picture in so many other movies.
It's the greatest single reading of "That's not right."
It really is.
And then he makes a noise.
Yeah.
There's a sound.
I can't reproduce the way he says
it. It's the single greatest reading of the line, "That's not right."
It's so good. It's funny. And it has no business being funny because we've heard that 1,000 times.
So again, I just, I don't want to get preachy, but one of the reasons why I like this movie is because it isn't mean-spirited and it doesn't go for cheap laughs. And I think it earns its emotional payoffs. And the message here, it seems, and it's not just for kids. And I recognize there's an ironic dichotomy in what I'm about to say.
I used to be in a band called Ironic Dichotomy.
You used to play Cabaret Metro a lot. And what was that other band called? Pop-Tarts of Doom. Then they broke up. And She-Males on Parade. And Punch Me. Do you remember Punch Me?
Punch Me is a great band name.
Miscreants, young miscreants used to steal the playbills, the advertising posters off telephone poles downtown because they said "Punch Me," and they would stick them to the backs of passersby, and you would get that old 50s thing like
nice.
Like "Kick Me," but right. This was "Punch Me."
The stakes and were upped.
It caused a lot of trouble. So yeah, the Patrick was in Ironic Dichotomy. The film is saying lying is bad. But by the same token, an inspiring fiction is something that's sometimes necessary. And it's okay to center your life around fiction, but you have to make sure that it's a good fiction.
And again, the movie works on so many levels because here's the movie saying that the TV show Galaxy Quest is a good fiction that's worth centering your life around for the fans. But then, at the same time, the movie Galaxy Quest, for reasons that we've gone on about for an hour, is a good fiction that, I mean, nobody's centering their life around the movie Galaxy Quest, but that it, on all these different levels, you have different versions of fiction, but they're all good.
And as you pointed out, the film works as an affectionate critique of Star Trek, but it also works on its own as an adventure that we begin to respond to as a separate adventure. That Galaxy Quest, the TV show, may be a little cheesy, but at one point, and that's another thing I like, when the film wants to make a point, it's not subtle. It explicitly states things. That the original Galaxy Quest show, though cheesy perhaps in a lot of ways, emphasized teamwork and courage and fellowship and those qualities, those good qualities, and certainly that's what the aliens picked up on. And I think the movie stresses the same things, but more subtly.
Right.
Sort of subversively, almost, given that it's trying to be this wacky comedy. At no point is the comedy subsumed by meanness or cheap jokes or that sort of puncturing of the main idea of the film that a lot of current comedies do. That if you come up with a joke that's funny enough, everything else can go out the window.
Right.
For the sake of that joke, which is odd because it flies in the face of the first rule of Second City. If Patrick establishes a fiction, it's too cheap of a laugh for me to come in and negate that fiction.
Right.
If Patrick holds up his forefinger and says, "This is a stick up," I can't say, "That's your finger," because that's just the easiest damn thing to do.
Right.
And in a weird way, that's where Tropic Thunder goes astray.
Because it says, "That's your finger"?
In a lot of different ways, I think it is doing that.
Yeah.
Although, to give it credit, and I think I've said this before, the sight of Jack Black in his underwear,
right,
holding a baby hostage and running to a mountain-sized pile of cocaine while screaming, "Don't judge me," is one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life.
It is very rare because Galaxy Quest does have a lot of these messages that you've hit on, but like you said, it isn't obvious about them, and that is really rare for any comedy, particularly a PG-rated comedy that's kind of directed at kids. I mean, obviously, Galaxy Quest works, I think, for all ages. Kids get something very different out of it than adults do. But, I mean, you can just imagine the version of this movie where, you know, in the third act, all of these themes and messages are very explicitly stated, and the strings are cue up on the soundtrack. It's the scene in every Eddie Murphy movie where his kids tell him he works too much. You know, it's that. It's the last scene in Full House. Every comedy now, especially, you know, quote unquote family comedy, has that moment.
And perhaps even worse, and I know Patrick has been expounding on this occasionally over the last year, the joke that's underlined, I've always called painting a mustache on it. Mm-hmm. I think you've said the joke is offered and then explained.
Mm-hmm.
That there's a secondary joke that's not a joke.
Right.
That in my mind ruins the first joke.
Saturday Night Live currently does that all the time. I think that's where you've heard me talk about that.
A fat man walks into the scene for no apparent reason. I think the joke is a non sequitur.
Mm-hmm.
And he's wearing a diaper. That's funny. Mm-hmm. It's a sight gag. It's a visual gag. It goes right back to silent comedy.
Right.
A character on screen turns to someone else and says, he's wearing a diaper.
Right.
And they might think that they're actually wringing two jokes out of it. That maybe someone's saying it.
Anchorman does that a lot. And I think that's what they think. That someone will say something nonsensical. The great example of that is Sex Panther. 70% of the time it works every time. Which is a great joke. And then Will Ferrell says, that doesn't make any sense. And maybe it's a second laugh, but no, it isn't. All it does is call attention to and ruin the joke that came before it.
Although the Sex Panther scene, where everyone tries to describe how it smells.
Yeah, that's funny.
That's one of the funniest things I've ever seen. Again, I wanted to mention that the film has scenes that take place at a science fiction convention. And I've been to a lot of horror / science fiction conventions. And I know Patrick has been to Comic-Con, not the big, fancy, important
San
one.
San Diego.
God knows not that, but the much smaller, much more modest version in Rosemont, Illinois. So we know of which we speak. And Patrick had mentioned that they put out an open casting call. They explained that you cannot wear anything recognizable from a fiction from Earth.
Don't come dressed as the Borg.
Right.
You have to create your own character.
Create your own character. And
that look like they belong in the universe of that show.
And the people who came out responded and did this admirably, and they're to be applauded. But I just wanted to make the point that the film's convention scenes are missing a very, very important component because, of course, this is a Hollywood film. Plus-size men. If you go to your average comic book convention, you will see an army of people who look like me. Husky plus-size men. And if you'd like some picture of this, I know it's hard to imagine because I live in northern Minnesota, but the bad guy, for lack of a better word, in Toy Story 3, the toy collector, voiced by Wayne Knight.
Toy Story 2,
I'm sorry. That pretty much looks exactly like me. So imagine an army of sort of egg-shaped weebles sort of walking around, and then you'll get the idea. Because a while ago, my wife and I said that the ultimate comic book science fiction fan, internet junkie, was a man named Gene. We invented this man named Gene. And Gene weighs 400 pounds, and he's never kissed a girl. And he lives in his mother's basement, and he has the world's largest internet shrine to Carrie Fisher as Princess Leia in the Jabba the Hutt slave girl costume.
Mm-hmm.
And Gene sounds something like this. Have you checked out my website? It's far out. So I've got the largest cache of JPEGs of Carrie Fisher in the Jabba the Hutt slave girl costume. She's hot.
You know what you need?
She's hot!
For your Gene impression is some very specific factoid about that scene that maybe not everyone knows, because that guy loves to have knowledge about something that you maybe don't have. It's fascinating to listen to people like at Comic-Con and stuff correct one another and one-up each other with
the esoteric joke. In fact, even better than the character that Wayne Knight voiced in Toy Story 2, I forget. I have a much better touchstone. It's the comic book guy.
Right.
It's the comic book guy from The Simpsons. Imagine an army of the comic book guy.
Right.
And you're right. They have the one esoteric fact. I have to get that. Usually the joke I make is, I have one hand on the mouse and the other hand in a bag of Doritos. because I like to keep my left hand greasy.
Gross.
My wife claims that if I had not married her, I would have become Gene. That she is the only thing standing between me and Genedom. So I would have liked to see a shout out to that. But otherwise, the verisimilitude of those convention scenes, specifically the odd religion slash desperation of the autograph line.
Right.
And I think we may have mentioned this on a previous podcast, but when you go to these things, there's some celebrities who are very popular, have long lines. And in all honesty, fans who are very nice, celebrities who are very nice with fans
mm-hmm.
and give them time mm-hmm. and listen to stories and stuff. And I get the feeling that some actors who honestly like to interact with fans, but then there's always the celebrity with no line. And he's got his 8x10s all laid out in front of him. And usually it's someone who's been part of some very popular franchise, but right. not in a very right. recognizable way.
Right.
Again, just like Guy Fleegman in the Galaxy Quest universe, it's that guy, the tangential guy.
2 years ago, maybe, I went to a Star Trek event or something at the Portage Theater.
Yes.
And William Shatner was supposed to come, and they were screening Star Trek 2 and 3 sort of round the clock, and they were going to have vendors, and William Shatner ended up canceling about 2 days before due to low attendance. And I thought, well, that's odd. I thought people would love to go see William Shatner, because when we were at Comic-Con last summer, it was out of control to see William Shatner. So I went during the day, and there was maybe 7 people there, I'm not exaggerating, and there was a guy out in the lobby. I forget his name, but he played Captain Pike in the episode of Star Trek called The Cage, which is mostly comprised of flashbacks to the pilot that they never aired. But then there's some scenes that take place in like the current day where Captain Pike...
It was specifically written so that they could use that
footage. And the current Captain Pike is sort of burned beyond recognition, and he's in this little thing the whole time. This was the guy in the makeup. During the current, he doesn't speak a line of dialogue, and he could not have seemed more close to blowing his brains out. Because not only does no one care he's there, no one is there. It's not even I'm watching people pass by me.
There's only 7 people total.
Right, and even they aren't paying attention to me.
And it's a pretty big space. I've heard that this gentleman, who has since passed away, was one of the nicest guys ever. And when Miguel, a friend of ours,
yes.
and I, we traveled to California to the second Famous Monsters convention, and he was there. And he was very nice to us. He loved to interact with the fans, and he was very generous with his time. His name was Bob May.
Okay.
And his circumstance reminds me of what you're talking about, because he was the robot in Lost in Space. And when I say that, I mean he was the guy inside the costume.
Right.
He didn't do the voice.
Right.
The voice was dubbed by an actor.
Right.
So this is the show business equivalent of...
Right. People get crazy about Peter Mayhew, though, and David Prowse, or, you know, like...
But I would even argue that Mayhew as Chewbacca was doing more acting...
Sure.
...than one could do...
right.
And would you like to see how I made the accordion-like hands
go flip and flop? Around, right.
And again, I'm not trying to be mean, because he was really nice and he had cool stories and stuff. But fame is a drug, and I think once you've had even a tiny taste, it's really hard. It always reminds me of the scene in Soap Dish where the Sally Field character, whenever she gets blue... She's a big soap opera star.
Right.
She goes to the mall because she knows she'll be mobbed
yep.
and given love yep. and she'll be giving autographs and things.
Tim Allen's biggest contribution to Galaxy Quest, I mean, his performance is good. Like I said, I like him in that movie. But in the original script, apparently, he was a guy who resented his situation a lot like the other characters in the movie do. He's not really happy with, this is my life, that I'm only this character. And Tim Allen, who had just finished, you know, a run on a very successful series where he's identified as, oh, you're the guy from Home Improvement, very quickly said, no, he loves this. this, you know, these were the best days of his life. He loves being this celebrity. And I think that works for the movie, if everybody's miserable, the movie's not the same.
And I've always, and again, it's nearly a perfect film. I mean, if you haven't seen it, you really need to see it. Mm-hmm. It's great. The one flaw I would find is I love the fact that the rest of the cast at the beginning of the film, they're completely burned out. They're completely tired of it. They're very upset with the Tim Allen character. And yet Tim Allen shows up and he's ready to give 100%.
Right.
I love that so much. And I don't understand why that guy would be demoralized to the extent that he is by the two idiots right. in the bathroom.
Right. Well, that scene always rings a little bit false to me, like it's a writer's
because
conceit.
He had to have heard
right.
And the rest of the film is so clever, I would like there to be something better to happen that causes his
right.
crisis of conscience
exactly
and his realization that he just may be washed
but
up.
That is the scene that inspired the screenwriter to actually write the film. He was at, I think, a Star Trek convention and went into the washroom and there were two Klingons standing at the urinal, and he thought that was just such a funny sight that was the genesis for Galaxy Quest.
Okay, but you can have a scene in
no,
the
I
restroom,
agree, I agree.
But
I don't like that scene.
Right.
Yeah, no, I don't think that scene works.
It rings false in a film full of truth.
I agree.
And so, in closing, I will say never retreat, never surrender.
And I will say, where's the beef?
Never retreat, never surrender, unless it's a lion.